The scripture reading this morning is from Exodus 17, verses 8 through 16. While the people of Israel were still at Rephidim, the warriors of Amalek attacked them. Moses commanded Joshua, "Choose some men to go out and fight the army of Amalek for us. Tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill, holding the staff of God in my hand." So Joshua did what Moses had commanded and fought the army of Amalek. Meanwhile, Moses, Aaron, and Hur climbed to the top of a nearby hill. As long as Moses held up the staff in his hand, the Israelites had the advantage. But whenever he dropped his hand, the Amalekites gained the advantage. Moses' arms soon became so tired he could no longer hold them up. So Aaron and Hur found a stone for him to sit on. Then they stood on each side of Moses, holding up his hands. So his hands held steady until sunset. As a result, Joshua overwhelmed the army of Amalek in battle. After the victory, the Lord instructed Moses, "Write this down on a scroll as a permanent reminder and read it aloud to Joshua. I will erase the memory of Amalek from under heaven." Moses built an altar there and named it Yahweh Nissi, which means, "The Lord is my banner." He said, "They have raised their fist against the Lord's throne. So now the Lord will be at war with Amalek generation after generation."
Morning, everybody. Thomas Jefferson said, "In matters of fashion, float with the current. In matters of principle, stand like a rock." Which, if you translate that to the 21st century, probably means something like, if you want to wear skinny jeans, fine. If you want to pretend that following Bernie Sanders or following Donald Trump is a fair substitute for following Jesus, don't. Don't get caught up in the tide of whatever happens to be going on right now. Don't get caught up with being worried about being on the wrong side of history. Stand. Stand on what is true. Stand on what is just. But stand. It can be an incredibly difficult thing to stand still, to not move when everyone else is moving, to not go with the current. If you think of being in a river, being in a current, and trying to stay in one place, it is hard and constant work. My older children they're now big enough that when we go to the beach, not the coast here, the beach in North Carolina where regular humans get in the water, when we go to the beach, they can go kind of in past their knees and actually swim around a little bit. And so they're experiencing the I thought I was just playing in the waves in one place, and now I'm 400 yards down the beach. Because while I thought I was standing, I was actually floating. Standing requires attention. It requires keeping our eye on a fixed point. That's my spot on the beach, and now I'm going to work to stay in front of it. Standing is not something that happens naturally. That's why we let you guys sit down while I preach. Because standing gets tiring. This story is God's people taking a stand, them standing. It's not necessarily a stand that they chose. It was forced upon them. But them doing the hard, the even impossible work of standing. And so in here we can find a model for how we are to do this hard and even impossible work of standing, of not getting caught in the current. And so we see that in shockingly three parts. We see God's people standing against. We see God's people standing together. And then we see God's people kneeling before. Standing against, standing together, and kneeling before. God's people stand against. Let's just go to the scariest, most difficult part of the text right off the bat. This is verses 14, 15, and 16. After the battle's been fought and the God's people have won, then the Lord, then God said to Moses, write this as a memorial in a book and recite it in the ears of Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek, the other army, the other people, from under heaven. And Moses built an altar and called the name of it, the Lord is my banner, saying, a hand upon the throne of the Lord. The Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. That is not Mr. Rogers. When I first started reading the Bible as a teenager, it was passages exactly like that that gave me the most trouble. This idea of God as a warrior, of God behaving violently, of God erasing a nation from history and from the earth. I was very much uncomfortable with that. I still am. I'm saying that in the past tense. It's still true. I'm all about the passages about God's faithfulness, his love and mercy, his sense of justice, the creative ways that he works good into the world. But when we get to something where God says, listen, I'm going to utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. I'm going to wipe these people off the face of the earth. I get troubled. That doesn't sound like a God I'm interested in or a God I particularly want to follow. What I've learned in the 15 years since I started encountering texts like these is that enemies are real and they are worth fighting. And God knows this, and most of God's people throughout time and even today throughout the world have known this. I don't know this because I'm a professor's kid. And I grew up in a college town, in a nice neighborhood, in a nice house. And if I, like, so when I would read these texts, I would try and think of enemies, and I would be like, the other middle school's basketball team? I don't know. Like, there one time Sam wasn't very nice to me in English class. What are we talking about here? Right? I lived in this world where it seemed like everybody was basically pretty nice. Not perfect or anything, but we could all just get along. It was Mr. Rogers' neighborhood. And that is not the way the world works. When you grow up like I did, when you live like I have, I'm now back in a college town, in this sort of Western upper middle class world, we experience the evil in the world exactly the same way we experience the weather. Right? Like, we gripe about it, but we have houses with waterproof roofs and insulation, and if you're as lucky as I am, even air conditioning for the summer. So if it's, my house is a little warmer when it's super hot outside and a little colder when it's super cold, but that's just because I want to save money. The insulation and the heating system basically keeps me from really experiencing what's going on in the world, and our society that we've constructed keeps us from really experiencing the evil in the world. But everyone else knows the enemies are real. That there is real darkness. And that the notion that human beings are basically good is a profoundly naive one. That can only be believed from a place of deep generational privilege. The enemies are real. We have forces and people that need to be stood against in the world. And we see those kind of break up into two related categories in this text. The first category is oppression, and the second category of enemies is fragmentation. Oppression and fragmentation. So the text begins, it reads kind of prosaic, but there's a lot here in verse 8. Then Amalek came and fought with Israel at Rephidim. That verse is dripping with oppression. Let me paint the picture for you. God's people, they were slaves for hundreds of years in Egypt, right? Experiencing oppression there, and they finally escaped, and they've made it across the Red Sea, and now they're out in the middle of the desert, and they have everything with them. This is men, women, children, old folks. They've got the sheep and the goats, and even more so, on the way out of Egypt, they took all of the valuables. God gave them all the money, the silver and gold, the jewels, the fine cloth. They're carrying a fortune with them. But they have no organized fighting forces. They've been brickmakers for generations. They know how to make bricks and take care of sheep, neither of which are very useful in a fight. And they're out here in the middle of the desert, not bothering anybody, but just out here, totally vulnerable, and somehow the people of Amalek hear about this and send an army. Because free stuff. Because we can pull this off. There's all the sheep and goats we could ever want. There's gold and silver and jewels that we can keep or trade or do whatever we want with. Let's go rape and pillage and plunder. Let's do this. Get the elite troops out. Get the fighting forces. We've got guns. Those poor natives, they don't even have good bows and arrows yet. Let's go get this done. That's verse 8. That's what Amalek is doing. They are sending an army to slaughter a people and take their valuables, their possessions, and their young girls. That's what this is about. Oppression is real and needs to be stood against. There are real oppressive forces and real people who have given themselves over to oppression in the world. There are dictators and drug dealers that need to be stood against. There are tyrants and tycoons. There are abusers and molesters. And it is a good thing. It speaks well of God's character that he desires to utterly blot out those memories. It is a good thing, and we should find consolation in the fact that God hates white supremacy. Isn't okay with it, doesn't look at somebody who openly declares himself to be a Nazi and wants to throw everyone who's not white out of the country and says, you know what, they're basically good. They've been led a little bit astray. It is a good thing that God hates that. It is a good thing that God hates abortion on demand. It speaks well of his character. That when he sees a society contriving a rationale to say, you know what, if you need to kill that child, it's for the greater good, God doesn't say, you know what, maybe there's some reasoning to that. He says, no, that's evil. This speaks well of God's character, that he sees the enemies of oppression and calls them what they are. We have real enemies in the world. And God recognizes it. We have enemies of oppression and we have enemies of fragmentation. We don't see fragmentation in this text. You see the opposite of it. And we'll get to that when we talk about standing together. You see all of God's people coming together to perform their various roles. Right? Joshua and Moses and Aaron and Hur and the soldiers are all working together, and we'll talk more about that in a minute. What normally would happen is the opposite of that. You see the army of oppression coming, and you take off. Maybe you take your wife and your kids. Maybe you take your own personal sheep or the most, you know, portable valuables that you took out of Egypt, and you run for it. You've heard the story, like two guys are out hiking and they see a bear coming, and one guy starts lacing up his running shoes and the other guy, what are you doing? Bears are way faster than we are. He's like, I don't have to outrun the bear, I just have to outrun you. This is our normal reaction. This is the tide, right? We went from 15 years ago, you have an American flag on the back of your car, and now you have an outline of the state of Oregon. In another 15 years, it'll be a little picture of a map of Corvallis, because we'll be done with the rest of Oregon. This is fragmentation. Let the rest of the world figure itself out. If other people have problems, those are other people's problems. If millions of people are starving to death in East Africa, that's East Africa. I don't have to worry about it. It's not my business. I wouldn't presume to interfere. That's fragmentation. And these oppression and fragmentation work together, do they not? Oppression creates fragmentation, creates a sense that I have to take care of me and mine if I'm even going to survive. And that fragmentation then enables more and more oppression. Martin Niemöller, no idea if I'm pronouncing that guy's last name right, was a German pastor in the 1930s and 40s, a leader of what was called the Confessing Church, the small kind of nugget of the church that actually stood and didn't roll with what was going on. And he said at the end of it this: first they came for the socialists, and I did not speak out because I was not a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. And then they came for the Jews, and I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. And then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me. The fragmentation that we flow with, the individualism and the privacy that we just roll along with, is what makes oppression happen in the world. I get it. I'm not preaching to dictators and drug dealers. I'm preaching to people like me with insulated lives who are okay with it getting really cold outside, as long as the furnace is working where I live. We enable and go along with fragmentation, which means we enable and go along with oppression. This is not what God's people are meant to do. As God's people, as children of the God who genuinely hates evil, who is good enough to despise and stand against evil, we stand against. We are not the massive institutional church in Germany that said, sure, it's fine, do whatever Hitler tells you to do. We are called to be Dietrich Bonhoeffer and stand up and say, no, this is wrong, this is evil, God hates what you are doing. God's children stand against. We see evil in the world. We don't hide behind our insulated walls. We see it. We call it what it is, and we stand against it. God's children stand against. And the way that we stand against, the only way that we can stand against, is by standing together. The only hope you have of standing against is standing together. You listen to me talk about these things and instinctively and rightly feel way too small. Come on, what are you going to do about white supremacy? What are you going to do about another 750,000 infants who will be destroyed this year? We can't fix that. I can't fix that. You can't fix that. We standing against cannot be done individually. To stand against, we have to stand together. And that's exactly what Israel does. Right? They see this army coming, and they don't have an army. But they get themselves organized, and everybody pitches in. Moses at this time is over 80 years old. Not ideal for a general. History says 80-something generals are very good at losing wars. And Moses knows this, says, I'm not going to run the army. Joshua, you're going to do that. Get everybody organized. Every guy who can pick up a shovel or a pick or a rake or whatever we've got, get them organized. We're going out to fight. I'll go up on the hill with the staff of God, which is sounds ridiculous, but it has been working, right? Everything Moses tries to do with that stick turns out okay. So that's what I can do with my 80-year-old self. Except Moses can't even do that by himself, can he? He gets up there and he has to hold the staff in the air for the battle to go well. If you ever, this is a day-long affair. I'm not even holding anything. If I try and do this for the next 20 minutes, my arm will get exhausted. Right? So Moses, he gets tired and he drops his arm. And all of a sudden, no matter what Joshua does down on the field of battle, no matter what the soldiers do, they're losing. And so he goes, okay. And then both arms get tired and he drops his arm. So Aaron and Hur, they find a rock. And they have Moses sit down on the rock, put your hand up, and we'll take turns just kind of standing there. And you can put your elbow on my shoulder or whatever you need to do, but keep that stick in the air, Moses. And everybody works together. Everybody has a role, and the battle is won. They can only stand against Amalek by standing together. We can only be God's people by standing together, by being brothers and sisters. This cannot be done as heroic individuals. We have to stand together. And the beauty of what's going on is that everybody has a role. Everybody has a different role. Some of them are silly. Some of them are totally anonymous, right? Most of the people in the story we don't know and we'll never know their names. They're the soldiers who were eighth from the left in the third row on that battlefield. And nobody bothered to write their name down. But they had a part to play in this. And everybody accepts their part and does it faithfully. There are, in God's people, no great parts and small parts, no worthy parts and unworthy parts. There are no major and minor roles. We all have our roles to play. Aaron and Hur's job was be furniture. Right? That was their role. If you flipped over to the New Testament, to the body of Christ metaphor, they're like the toenail on the little toe. What is this job? And yet it is indispensable. Right. Moses is Moses. I mean, he's the guy. How many movies have we made about him? He's one of the, maybe number two behind Jesus in terms of human figures in the Bible. He's way up there. His job, hold a stick in the air. Just keep it up there. Right? Use those profound leadership skills, years of experience, all of your powers and abilities. Get the stick up in the air. Right? Joshua has, in theory, the starring role. Right? He's the general. He's supposed to be the war hero. He's the person who's going to get elected president next. And apparently nothing he does has anything to do with the outcome of the battle. We have no idea if he used the best tactics ever or if he was boneheaded or what. It didn't matter. The battle's decided based on where that stick is. Right? None of these roles are anything to get puffed up about. And none of them are anything to get down on themselves about. They're just what's given to them. We all have different roles. Dawn and I are both deeply grateful that she's the one playing the piano and singing and I'm the one preaching. We're not trading. Right? And you should be too, at least when it comes to the piano thing. Right? And neither one of those is better than the other. And both of them together aren't better than what Ed and Lois are doing as ushers. Or what Kim's doing teaching children's church. When my family gets together for Christmas, we have this. Everybody's roles worked out, right? Mine is breakfast on Christmas morning. So I get up super early because I'm weird and I like to do that anyway. And make French toast and bake it and everything before everybody else gets up. That's my job. Brennan hates cooking. He does dishes like 4 hours a day the whole time because there's a lot of people and we eat a lot, right? Dad does crab fried rice for dinner that day. It's delicious. We all have our jobs, and none of them is more important than any other. Right? They are what they are. Whatever role is given to you, whatever place you stand in God's people, is nothing to get puffed up about. Nothing to look around and say, ah, aren't I impressive? Aren't I important? And nothing to get down on yourself about. This was the only role I could get. Like I tried out to be the leading lady, and then I got extra number 17. All of these things matter. We stand together. God's people function together. We are bound and knit together because we cannot do it on our own. Whatever God has given you to do, even if nobody else sees it, matters. Whatever it is, it was given to you by God. Stand there and stand faithfully and know that you are not standing alone. As God's people, we stand together. Even that's not enough. Even that doesn't get the job done a lot of the time. We, the church, in 2,000 years, have a very mixed track record of utterly blotting out the memory of evil from the world. Sometimes we do some really good work. Sometimes we are the evil in the world. Us, broken people, standing together, doesn't cut it. And so ultimately, in order to stand, we have to kneel. In order to stand against evil, we stand together, and then we kneel together before the one who is truly good. We cannot stand alone. We have to kneel. I hope you notice this is a ridiculous battle strategy that makes no sense. From start to finish, send unarmed, untrained people out against an elite attack force. Bad idea. Put all of your chips in the will the old guy keep the stick in the air pot. Bad idea. That's like betting on an inside straight. Don't go there. It intentionally makes no sense. This is God saying as loudly and emphatically as he can, this depends on me and not on you. There is no earthly reason why that stick being in the air should affect the outcome of the battle. But I am in control. I am your God, and I will take care of you. In the end, I will utterly blot out all evil from the world. I am going to get this done. And so when we find ourselves hopelessly inadequate, totally unable to effectively stand against evil, when we find ourselves losing all hope. Can you imagine what it was like to stand in the front rank of Joshua's army with your shovel or your shepherd's crook? And here comes real soldiers with shields and spears and armor and helmets and bloodlust in their eyes charging down at you. What kind of hope could you possibly have? When we find ourselves in that place, or looking around us in the pews going, us, we're going to stand together and we're going to make a difference. Don't pretend you've never done that. Nope. God will. So Moses understands this, and after the battle, to remind his people, hey, we didn't do this. He builds an altar and he calls it, the Lord is my banner. A banner in a battle, this is the rallying point. This is what leads you. This is what directs you when all gets lost and chaotic and you don't know what to do. You come back to the banner to reorganize and keep on fighting. And Moses is in the wake of a battle using a battle metaphor and saying, that will always be God for us. It will not be anything else. It will not be the tranquility of our home. It will not be how awesome last Sunday's church service was. It won't be our small group. It won't be how well things are going at work. It won't be the quality of my devotional life. It won't be what's happening politically in the city or in the state or in the nation. God and God alone is our banner. He is our rallying point. He is the one that sees us through. Him and no one and nothing else, only him. And so we come before him and fall on our knees. Moses, he builds an altar, which is this pile of rough-cut stones where worship can happen, where all of the people could gather together after they won the great battle and fall on their knees and say, not by our own might. This is our habit as God's people. That at the end of a day in which we have stood well, in which we have stood together, in which we have stood against evil, we would not be puffed up and impressed with ourselves. We would not think, oh, we got this now. We're on the right track. But at the end of a day like that, a day of victory and joy and accomplishment, we would fall on our knees and say, we did not do this. The Lord is our banner. And we have to do it on those days because there are going to be other days. Days of darkness and defeat. Days where we not only lost ground, but it seems like we joined the other side. Where we couldn't stand at all. We spent the whole day crawling or floating along. And at the end of days like that, we will need to fall on our knees and say, the Lord is my banner. And rally back to him. God and God alone is the one who helps us to stand against evil, because God and God alone is the one who has already borne the worst that evil can offer. Jesus came to earth and lived in a time of great oppression when God's people weren't even a nation unto themselves, when they couldn't even organize to fight against an army because they had no grouping in which to do so, and laid down underneath all of that oppression, was wrongfully accused and executed by one of the most tyrannical states that has ever been. Jesus took the worst that oppression has to give. And in doing that, Jesus experienced every possible kind of fragmentation. He was separated from his people, who rather than standing together with him, crowded into the middle of the square and shouted, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" He was fragmented and separated from his closest friends, who not 24 hours before had said, "We will follow you to death. We are with you. We're never going to forsake you. We're never going to abandon you. Just kidding. There's bad guys coming." And ran the other way, just like you and I have done time and again. Jesus was separated in his experience even from his Father in heaven, so that after a lifetime of continually praying to God and only calling him Father or Abba, Daddy, on the cross he is so alone, so fragmented and broken, that instead of referring to God as his Father, the one and only time he says instead, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Jesus took the very worst that loneliness and isolation, fragmentation and separation can bear, and came back from it. He died the death that we are trying to die when we float along in the current of fragmentation and oppression. He died that death in our place and then rose from the grave. It did not make any sense. It was as crazy as a guy holding a stick in the air and winning a battle, that somebody who was dead would stop being dead and be alive forevermore. But Jesus broke the power of death, and he is our banner. He stands forever against every form of evil. And so when we stand together, we don't stand together only with the broken people around you. We stand together with him. He is our banner. And in him, evil will be erased, and we will have victory. Let's pray. Jesus, thank you for standing against evil. Thank you for standing against it when it was Amalek, when it was Rome, when it was Babylon. Thank you for standing against the evil that lives within us. The selfishness that would say, hey, I'm not one of the people being hurt, so things are okay. Thank you for being good enough to hate every form of evil, every form of oppression and fragmentation. And we pray that you would pour out your Spirit in us. Fill us with the same goodness, the same love of good and hatred of evil. You would fill us with the courage and the steadfastness to stand against, the faithfulness and the humility to stand together. The love and the trust to kneel before you always. For you are our banner. No matter how many times we fail, no matter how many times we fall, no matter how many times we choose never to get out of the chair in the first place, you are and always will be our banner. And we put our trust in you. Amen.